The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Hello and welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. This is Richard Palmer coming to you live from our studio in Edstone, England, standing in for your regular host, Mr. Stephen Flory. And today, it seems so far at least everything's working, coming to you as normal if you're listening to us on air at the Trumpet website, online at the Trumpet website or kpcg.fm. Everything seems to be back to normal and working this morning. No YouTube live streams. I think the only thing that doesn't seem to be working is the heater in here, so if you hear me chattering a little, you shall know why, but just got that turned on. Well, lots to talk about as usual in the news. Like I said, Mr. Flory, he's not here. He's heading over to Ireland. I'm standing in today. Mr. Brad McDonald will be on the show tomorrow. And for some of the news today, well, I thought I'd start with actually, a pretty dumb one that just happened to catch my attention. But it does still serve an important purpose. America's national debt, as I think all of you know, is huge, gigantic, unimaginably big. I think it was the physicist Richard Feynman who talked about we should get rid of the term astronomical. We should instead use economical, because economics numbers are so much bigger even than anything you get in astronomy. America's debt is vast. And I saw where some people online have come up with a solution, a way to actually do something about this debt. And the solution is sell Montana to Canada. There is a change.org petition with over 7,000 signatures to sell Montana to Canada for $1 trillion. The text of this petition states, and I quote, "We have too much debt and Montana is useless. Just tell them it has beavers or something." Now, before I offend all our Montanan listeners, I have to say I have been to Montana. The little corner that I went to was absolutely beautiful. I think the US would be crazy to sell it. And if Canada bought it for $1 trillion, it would be a bargain. And it wouldn't surprise me if some of those 7,000 signatures are Canadians hoping to get a hold of Montana. Some of the comments included, "I'm Montanan and hoping to join Canada without the moving costs. Let's do this. Please adopt us." Another said that Montana ruins the USA's aesthetics. Another signature, "I'm Canadian and making Canada bigger is cool." And I guess in other news, Russia is talking about getting back together with Belarus. So, Canada's scheme to become the world's largest country by breaking up Russia seems to be running out of steam at this point. So if they want to keep going with their aim of becoming the world's largest country, they'll have to start buying up U.S. states. I mean, maybe if they could see if they could get Alaska for its original purchase cost, that would really give them a leg up in that race. More seriously, though, helps drive home the massive size of America's debt. $1 trillion. The cost for selling, picked out of the air, I'm sure, for selling Montana, but it would only cover 1 year of America's borrowing. And that's not total spending, just 1 year of borrowing. U.S. debt is $22 trillion. I mean, you know that you've got a debt problem if selling Montana doesn't even come close to beginning to cover your debts. Now, apparently, thus far on the show, I have been really uncool, not just because I've been mean to Montana, or because I just used the word cool, which is now so common that no cool person would use it. But it's been because I've been talking about national debt. The Wall Street Journal had an article yesterday, "Worrying about deficit falls out of style." And they wrote, "It is no longer cool to talk about the federal budget deficit." And there you go. If the Wall Street Journal is using a term, well, it definitely isn't cool. They write that one of the reasons deficit concerns are low is the country has been living with the federal deficits for a long while now, and the economic calamity some have predicted has never materialized. So we've just gotten used to now this massive debt. I see headlines about debt just about every day. and how big it's growing. But nobody in politics really wants to talk about it anymore. So it's one of the big stories. It's one of the things that is keeping on getting worse, and it's one of the things that nobody wants to do anything about. And okay, yeah, the day of reckoning hasn't come yet, but that doesn't mean that America can just keep borrowing infinitely and put off the day of reckoning. And in fact, the Bible makes very clear that there are financial crises and consequences for this massive debt coming soon. Another piece of news I thought I'd talk about, we'll just go through a few bits of news at the beginning of the show, and then we'll get more deeply into our main subject in a few minutes. Germany is about to make it much easier for itself to sell weapons overseas. Deutsche Welle had an article on this yesterday. They wrote, Germany is preparing to compromise its arms export guidelines to facilitate joint defense projects with France, according to an internal government document. So, because of Germany's history, until now they've had more restrictive laws on who they sell weapons to and policies on who they sell weapons to. And really, the companies involved often find loopholes. For example, this article talks about Germany not selling weapons to Saudi Arabia. They were selling them to Saudi Arabia. They banned it. And so Rheinmetall was one of the companies that got banned from selling weapons to Saudi Arabia. They just had Rheinmetall Italia. The Italian branch of Rheinmetall keep selling the same weapons after the ban came in force. It didn't end up doing anything. So these restrictions are more hoops to jump through and things that other companies get around than anything meaningful. But even these are about to be lifted. This article continues, Germany is working to loosen its arm control export rules to make it easier to continue with joint weapon programs with France, according to an internal strategy paper obtained by Der Spiegel magazine. And this is really interesting. They write, Der Spiegel describes the paper as a secret adjunct to the Aachen Friendship Treaty signed in January, which pledged cooperation on a host of future projects. So we talked a fair bit about this friendship treaty at the time between France and Germany. Trumpet editor-in-chief Gerald Flurry had written a series of articles even before that was announced, talking about, well, watch this growing relationship between France and Germany. France is really enabling the rise of Germany, leading Europe. And now we're starting to find out, well, at least according to Der Spiegel, there was a secret part of that treaty. And at least one of the parts of that secret part of that treaty, according to Der Spiegel, is this effort to make it easier for Germany to sell weapons abroad so Germany and France can work on joint projects. I mean, if there's a secret part of the treaty, who knows what else is in there? But that's Der Spiegel saying there was a secret part of the Aachen Friendship Treaty. That will definitely be something to keep an eye on for news over the coming weeks and months. Continuing with this article, it states Chancellor Angela Merkel indicated that Germany ought to compromise on the issue during her speech at the Munich Security Conference on Saturday, when she said that a common European defense policy would necessarily mean a common arms export policy. So even at that speech at the weekend, she was making it clear that Germany may well start selling weapons all around the world more easily. So this is it's both an important step towards Europe uniting and Germany and France working together more on these big military projects. And again, that's something Mr. Flurry has drawn attention to. And also an important step towards Germany militarizing. And we're working currently on the next edition of the Trumpet magazine. I guess that would be the April edition. And there's a big article getting ready for that on Germany militarizing, on how this country that right now only spends 1.5% of their economy on their military could rapidly become a major military power because of their massive industrial capacity and expertise in manufacturing weapons. And now you're seeing the doors about to open for Germany to really sell and export even more weapons all around the world. So a couple of key trends there. Another article that really ties in with this trend, this is from Reuters yesterday. Wake up, Macron will tell Europe in major pre-Brexit speech. And they write that French President Emmanuel Macron will describe Brexit as a wake-up call in a speech in coming weeks in which he will outline how Europe must be more assertive in the face of rival world powers, sources close to Macron said. His words are intended as a warning shot for a continent unable to project power and defend itself, said aides who described the speech as Macron's most important since he spoke at Sorbonne University in Paris in September 27, 2017, urging fundamental reform of the European Union. So, you know, he's talking about Europe being has to be more assertive in the face of rival powers. A warning shot telling Europe we must change radically. We must unify radically. So another very important trend to watch. Europe militarizing, Europe reforming, Europe coming together into a super state with Germany at the top and France helping to facilitate that. Another piece of news over from the last few days. Spain is about to hold their third elections in 3.5 years. They've just called those and scheduled those for late March. And so you see yet another country in Europe now where their politics is just stopping functioning, where every year they keep having to hold fresh elections because their governments just can't get anything done. In Spain, it's split and fractured because you've got the left, you've got the right, and you've got the Catalan separatists that want independence, and none of those groups can get along. But you've seen the same thing in country after country. We just had Sweden spend about 6 months or so trying to get a government together. And these are the kind of crises that Macron's talking about and saying, well, Europe, we need to change to face. They're having a crisis of democracy where they just can't get their politics to function in the current conditions. In Spain, you're also seeing the rise of a far-right party, Vox, for the first time in their democratic history. First time since General Franco, the far-right are rising in Spain. So just more signs of this political paralysis in Europe. The Bible tells us that there's a strong leader and even a set of strong leaders coming to Europe. And you can see how this paralysis is leading to this, where you just have election after election after election. Nothing gets done. There's no progress made. Nothing happens. And the public just starts to feel, well, what we need is just a suspension of the democratic process, a strong leader to come and help us out. And you have a crisis hit, a crisis triggered by an economic crisis related to this massive debt that we see building all over the world. And you can really see how these leaders or these people in their paralyzed countries would just vote in a strong leader to help deal with that problem. So you can really see the different aspects of this crisis all coming together and building. Now, this relates a bit to the Spanish piece, to a big piece of British news from yesterday. Major news, at least for us here in the UK, a split in the Labour Party. The Labour Party is the main left-wing party over here. You could say it's the UK's equivalent of the Democrats. And seven members, MPs, quit from this party. Seven might not seem like much, but they were some at least outspoken and fairly well-known names from that party. And this is rumoured to be just the first, that there could well be more coming, and even becoming a foundation of a new political party. They're generally left-wing, still kind of more kind of in terms of more pro-government, bigger government. But they're not socialist. They're generally pro-EU. They still want to override Brexit. They still want the government to ignore the wishes of the people and the clear results of the referendum and keep Britain as much as possible in the European Union. But they disagree with the direction that the Labour Party's heading in at the moment. They think that the Labour Party isn't pro-EU enough, and they think that the Labour Party has shifted far too far to the left, that it's gone way too far to socialism and communism. And this is a big part of the reason why they quit. Here's a couple of clips from their press conference yesterday where they announced that they were splitting from the Labour Party. And it gives you a sense of of how far left the Labour Party has shifted today.
But British politics is now well and truly broken. And in all conscience, we can no longer knock on doors and support a government led by Jeremy Corbyn or the team around him. The past 3 years have confirmed how irresponsible it would be to allow this leader of the opposition to take the office of Prime Minister of the United Kingdom. Many people still in the Labour Party will privately admit this to be true, but we owe it to our constituents now to say it publicly and honestly. The pursuit of policies that would threaten our national security through hostility to NATO, the refusal to act when needed to help those facing humanitarian distress, preferring to believe states hostile to our country, rather than believing our police and security services. These are all rooted in the Labour leadership's obsession with a narrow, outdated ideology. They're hostile to business, large and small. They make impossible promises which everybody knows, in their hearts, couldn't be kept without putting the economy at risk. And they constantly pit one part of society against another, because to them, the world divides between oppressor and oppressed, class enemies, when in truth, the modern world is more complicated than this. And then, as Luciana was saying, there is an appalling culture. Intolerance, closing down of debate, abuse and hatred online, as you're seeing this morning, and offline in party meetings, and anti-Semitism. So we have no choice but to say collectively, enough is enough. There has to be a better way forward, and there can be a better way forward.
So they're quitting the party. And a lot of these, like I said, they are left-wing people. They have been part of previous Labour governments, but the Labour Party has gotten to the point now it's so far left, so radically left-wing, that they're quitting the party. They're leaving it. They're in the early stages now of forming a new political party. The Times, I think this was Rachel Sylvester, she wrote that, "I am told that as many as 50 other Labour MPs are considering their positions and could be prepared to resign the party whip once the Brexit issue has been resolved. One senior figure described yesterday as wave one of the rebellion, with a much bigger wave two to come if Mr. Corbyn does not shift his position and approach." So if they don't see any changes from the leadership, you could get lots more leaving. So it shows how far left the leadership has gone. It also shows this continued British political dysfunction, just like we're seeing in Europe, where, I mean, in a lot of ways, this new split, it adds to the idea of just everything is falling apart. The Labour Party is in crisis. The Conservative Party is in crisis. The government's struggling to come together with a coherent Brexit strategy. They've wasted 2 years doing nothing much. The BBC underscored this yesterday by accidentally broadcasting some member of the media somewhere, kind of talking in the background about how big of a mess British politics is now. And Brexit is a big part of this. It's opposition to Brexit. Jeremy Corbyn and his, you know, he has actually been anti-EU historically. Generally, this is not because he's proud of Britain or believes Britain is as strong and needs to be and can be a great nation on its own. Instead, he believes he's so far to the radical left, he believes the EU is too right-wing, and that if he wants to turn Britain into the communist utopia that he would like, he needs to be outside the EU. So this is part of the reason why he isn't more on board or more pro-EU. But the Brexit is at the heart of why another reason why a lot of these people are quitting. And because of this, there's rumours that even some Conservatives might join this new party because they're pro-EU. Going back to this article from The Times, it states yesterday's announcement by seven MPs that they have quit the Labour Party to form a new independent group is the start of something much bigger at Westminster, because it is not just about politics, it is about values and culture. The article says that if a quotes a anonymous, I think, Conservative Party member saying that if a hardline Brexiteer becomes leader, then at least a dozen Conservative MPs would quit. And this article says, if the independents who left Labour yesterday could soon be joined by Conservatives who feel equally uncomfortable in their party, and possibly also Liberal Democrats if they are willing to relinquish their tainted brand. The political Rubik's Cube has been scrambled by Brexit, and now red, blue, yellow and green are all muddled up. At Westminster, the party whipping system, which is just this, you know, grouping into two political parties or however many, but grouping into political parties. The party whipping system is all but defunct as Tory, Labour and Liberal Democrat MPs form an alliance to defeat the government. With cultural and generational differences becoming more important than the old left and right divides, the traditional parties are looking increasingly obsolete. So the country's so divided that even two or three political parties aren't enough to contain those divisions, and even those are splitting. And we've read this comment several times on this show, where right at the start, when Britain joined the EU, Herbert W. Armstrong said, Britain is going to look back on Monday, January 1st, 1973, as a most tragically historic date, a date fraught with ominous potentialities. And that was the date Britain joined the EU. Now we see Britain leaving the EU, and just even trying to deal with that leaving and disentangling ourselves from this, getting there, is really playing a major toll on so many different areas of Britain, and politics is one of those big ones. You really see British politics fracturing under the strain of getting out of the EU. I have an article in the latest Trumpet print called "Why Brexit is Breaking Britain," that talks about just, you know, well, just the way that Britain's inability to handle leaving the EU, it really is a very clear and dramatic fulfillment of so many Bible prophecies that talk about Britain's leadership, Britain's political system being in a horribly sick, weak, infirm condition. And as soon as they're put under stress, like leaving the EU, as soon as they've got to try and confront a tough task, everything just falls apart. And you see more of that now with the Labour Party splitting, the Conservative Party potentially splitting. So you can read that article if you want more on this, Brexit is Breaking Britain. We'll take a short break, and when we get back, we'll talk about another important aspect of this breakaway party that ties into a much bigger, much more important, and much more long-lasting trend.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily. Perhaps no hour in Britain's history was darker than that preceding World War II. Nazi Germany was arming. Nations in Europe were being conquered, their borders redrawn. Britain, the nation that once ruled one quarter of the earth, teetered on the edge of survival. Many leaders in Britain feared war. They wanted to disarm. They spoke of peace as Europe sank deeper into the pit of war. This dark hour may have been Britain's last, were it not for one man. This man stood alone in the face of adversity at home and abroad. He rose to the occasion when his nation needed him most. He vowed that Britain would never surrender when confronted by forces of evil. Winston Churchill took Britain's most important job during Britain's darkest hour. He did what others were afraid to do. Some doubted his methods, but the results speak for themselves. Churchill led Britain from the precipice of ignominious defeat and possible death to what became one of the nation's brightest hours. What was it that made Winston Churchill so different from other leaders of his time? Surely now, more than ever, this world needs another Winston Churchill. Our booklet, Winston S. Churchill, The Watchman, explains what made this man such a great leader. We would like to offer this booklet to you free of charge. Email your request to td@kpcg.fm or visit thetrumpet.com. This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily.
Hello, and welcome back to the Trumpet Daily radio show. This is Richard Palmer standing in for your regular host, Mr. Stephen Flurry. Well, now I'd like to talk about one of the really big trends in the news today, a very important one, very dramatic one, one that I see headlines about just about every single day. And like I mentioned at the start, or before the end of the last segment, this story, this trend was also a big part of the reason that these MPs have broken away from the Labour Party. One of the major reasons that several of them emphasized when they left the Labour Party is because of anti-Semitism, because this party and because the far left are anti-Semitic and tolerating this anti-Semitism, and that, you know, they're taking a stand against this rising anti-Semitism in British politics. Here's a montage with a few of their speakers speaking at that press conference yesterday, talking about this problem.
This morning, we have all now resigned from the Labour Party. This has been a very difficult, painful, but necessary decision. For my part, I have become embarrassed and ashamed to remain in the Labour Party. I cannot remain in a party that I have today come to the sickening conclusion is institutionally anti-Semitic. It was nearly a year ago that we saw the unprecedented event of a minority community, the Jewish community, taking to Parliament Square to demonstrate against the Labour Party, to say, enough is enough. And yet since then, despite a mountain of evidence, we have only seen the situation of racism against Jewish people get worse. The leadership has willfully and repeatedly failed to address hatred against Jewish people within its ranks. And it is for these reasons and many more that I have made this decision today.
I am sickened that the Labour Party is now a racist, anti-Semitic party.
Any criticism of the leadership is responded to with abuse and accusations of treachery. Anti-Semitism is rife and tolerated. The current leadership have been very successful at changing this party beyond recognition.
And they're right, this has been a major problem in the modern Labour Party. Both the big leaders, you know, John McDonnell, we spoke about a bit earlier, Jeremy Corbyn especially, Mr. Flory spoke about John McDonnell a bit, I think it was last week, but Jeremy Corbyn especially, you know, he's shared and liked online anti-Semitic cartoons and anti-Semitic messages. He's, of course, friends with Hamas and Hezbollah. He's called them our friends. He's attended memorial services for terrorists that died trying to target Jews. I think there was a video that surfaced a while ago with him laying a wreath. I think it was the terrorists that were involved in the Munich massacre that attacked Jewish athletes. So, you know, horrible levels of anti-Semitism that have turned a blind eye to that. Generally, when senior Labour Party members have been asked about anti-Semitism, they've said that no, there's no anti-Semitism. The accusations of anti-Semitism are just part of an evil conspiracy by Jews to try and smear the party and hurt the working man, which is hardly a comforting answer to those accusations. And so it's gotten to the point that several of these members felt that they really had no option but to quit. And like I said, I see headlines or even multiple headlines on this story just about every single day. Here's just a handful from around the world just from the last week or so. France. So they just recently they published the number of anti-Semitic incidents that took place in 2018, the final figures. And they found that it rose from 311 anti-Semitic registered incidents of anti-Semitism in 2017 to 541, an increase of 74%. Their interior minister said anti-Semitism is spreading like a poison, like a venom. Just in the last few days, you had swastika scores drawn on a post box that had portraits of a Holocaust survivor. There was a tree, a memorial to an anti-Semitic victim or a victim of anti-Semitism vandalized. The word Juden, German for Jews, sprayed in yellow paint on the window of a bagel shop. There was another study that found that 44% of the yellow vests in these big protests that have been sweeping France thought there was a global Zionist plot to rule the world. So an alarming rise in anti-Semitism there, and an alarming rise in these fringe groups all across Europe are often strongly associated with anti-Semitism. Another study showed a 69% uptick in anti-Semitic attacks in 2018. That was an Israeli report. So more of these different reports showing a massive increase. And we were talking about the same thing last year. Every year we're talking about a massive increase in anti-Semitism from the year before. It just keeps on getting bigger and bigger. In fact, it's one of the reasons perhaps why this story doesn't get talked about more. It's a bit like the American debt that we talked about at the start. Yeah, you just kind of get used to hearing stories about America has a gigantic debt. America has a gigantic debt, and it reaches higher and higher and more mind-boggling levels every year. But we're just kind of used to hearing that headline, used to hearing that story, And so it becomes so easy to tune it out. Yeah, I know that. America's got a big debt. Okay, I've kind of gotten used to that, and I'm used to not worrying about it. And it's a bit like, it can be like that with anti-Semitism as well. Every year we hear the anti-Semitism's rising here, it's rising there, it's rising in this place. This statistic shows that it's rising. That statistic shows, and it becomes easy to tune it out. To just, okay, yeah, I know, anti-Semitism's rising. Don't need to think about it too much. But it really is a disturbing and alarming story that just keeps getting worse every year. So that was France. Germany. Again, in the last fortnight or so, there have been more statistics from Germany. Their anti-Semitic attacks, at least according to police reports, were up 10%. They recorded 1,646 offenses motivated by hatred against Jews. And that included 62 violent offenses that left 43 people injured. And that was up from 37 violent offenses the previous year. So from 37 to 62, a big, big increase. One of the, I think this was somebody with the police that's tasked with confronting anti-Semitism. She said, "I have the impression that anti-Semitism is becoming louder, more open and aggressive. In addition, in comparison to the population in Germany, most anti-Semitic offences are recorded nationwide. Unfortunately, this also applies to anti-Semitic violent crime." So anyway, you've just got this uptick in Germany. She talked about how anti-Semitism is deeply rooted in German society. Then here in the UK, this was from the Community Security Trust, published again, I think this was last week. And this, the Community Security Trust, they help organise protection for synagogues and schools because they need it. And you visit just about any synagogue in anywhere in Europe. I mean, obviously, I haven't been to every country in Europe. I haven't been to a synagogue in Scandinavia. Maybe that's a bit safer. I don't know. It wouldn't surprise me if it's not. But they've always got security guards outside. They've always got, usually got bars over the windows because they need to have that. So anyway, this Community Securities Trust, they reported a 16% increase in anti-Semitic incidents in 2018. That was 1,652 incidents in total. And this was the highest number of incidents against Jews since this organization began keeping track in 1984. And this is the third year in a row for having the highest level ever. So in 2016, it was the highest level ever with 1,372 incidents. 2017 was the highest level ever, again, with 1,420. Now, 2018 was the highest level ever, again, with 1,652. And they said that this year had the first case of extreme violence since 2015. And extreme violence is any attack potentially causing loss of life or grievous bodily harm. Here's one that I just saw from, well, I saw it today. It's from the New York Times, published online yesterday, so maybe this morning's edition. And, well, they start their article by writing, "One video showed a 51-year-old Jewish man being beaten to the ground by three young men who seemed to select him at random. Another showed an Orthodox Jewish man being chased across the street by a man wielding a tree branch. A third showed an Orthodox Jewish man hanging on the fence onto a fence as an assailant jumped and choked him. The three incidents, all of which took place in Crown Heights, Brooklyn, in the past year, have raised alarms in the neighborhood and in the city's large Orthodox Jewish community as a whole. Hate crimes are up citywide, but in Crown Heights, they have taken a particularly violent turn. There were 55 hate crime crimes reported in New York City this year as of February 17th, an increase of 72% over the same period last year," the police said. "Anti-Semitic crimes made up almost two-thirds of that. A total of 36 crimes reported so far this year compared with 21 last year." Now, it doesn't make clear whether that's 21 at this point last year or 21 for the entire year. If it is 21 for the entire year, that's a massive jump. 36 crimes for the total this year already. And the New York Times write, "The steep rise comes after a year when hate crimes were already increasing. Anti-Semitic crimes in 2018 were up 22% compared with 2017. And then it talks about more of these attacks, an attack on a Chabad synagogue with a window being broken, objects thrown at this church, or the synagogue, vandalized. And I guess this is just from the last 2 weeks. These type of stories are coming up every day, and they're everywhere. America, Europe, obviously in the Middle East. And you look at some of the attitudes, you know, these attacks are becoming more and more common. But then you start to look at the percentages of the population that hold anti-Semitic views, and there are some really frightening statistics. Obviously, most of the people that hold these views are not carrying out attacks right now, but it really shows the potential for even more dramatic and widespread anti-Semitism. The European Union Agency for Fundamental Rights, they published a survey in 2018, and they found that from a majority of Jews in Europe said that anti-Semitism is a serious problem that threatens their way of life. Majority of Jews said that. This was the poll looked at 16,500 Jews, and 89% said they felt like anti-Semitism in Europe had increased over the last 5 years. The overwhelming majority, they said that anti-Semitism is the biggest social or political problem in the media, social media, politics, and public areas. There's CNN, we've talked about this before. They had a dramatic poll back in the November. They looked at 7,000 people in Britain and Europe. And they said that, well, they said that 34%, so over a third of Europeans, knew little or nothing about the violence and, you know, basically about the Holocaust. Little or nothing about Jews being killed in the Holocaust and Hitler's Germany in the Second World War. 5% said they'd never even heard of the Holocaust. In France, 20%. One in five people never heard of the Holocaust. For those who were familiar with the history of the Holocaust, 33%, so again a third, said that the Jews used the memory of it to advance their own positions or goals. And the FRA survey, it found a similar thing, that 35% said that Jews exploit Holocaust victimhoods for their own purposes. So they've forgotten that history, and they've believing even crazy lies about that history. They found that in Poland and Hungary, 4 out of 10 said that Jews have too much influence in business and finance around the world. 1 in 3 said that Jews were too influential in political affairs around the world. A quarter in Poland and Hungary said they had too much influence in the media. A third of Austrians said Jews have too much influence in finance. A quarter of French and Germans said the same thing. 1 in 5 and across all these countries said Jews have too much influence in the media again. And a quarter said they had too much influence on wars and conflicts. So you're seeing a rise in the same kind of anti-Semitic theories, or not theories, propaganda, lies that were going around in the 1930s, that you've got the Jews causing wars and manipulating finance behind the scenes. These are the same kind of views you had in the Labour Party that caused these people to quit. 20%, according to the CNN poll, found that 20% of Europeans believe that anti-Semitism is a justifiable reaction to Jewish people's behavior. So just some really crazy statistics. But you also see this playing out in the world scene as well. The way that Israel is singled out for criticism, is held up as a standard that no other country is held to, is that it's people make excuses for its enemies that they would not do for any other country. You've had over 700 resolutions condemning Israel within the United Nations, and none condemning Hamas. That's just an anti-Semitism at an international level. And you see this in nations like Iran, in nations that talk about wiping Israel off the map. U.S. Vice President Mike Pence, he talked about that at the Munich Security Conference over the weekend. Here's just a quick couple of clips from his speech as he drew attention to this.
Anti-Semitism is not just wrong. It's evil. And anti-Semitism must be confronted wherever and whenever it arises, and it must be universally condemned. The Iranian regime openly advocates another Holocaust, and it seeks the means to achieve it. The Ayatollah Khomeini himself has said, it is the mission of the Islamic Republic of Iran to erase Israel from the map.
And as he said, yes, anti-Semitism is behind that. And really, in making those points, he was having a go at Europe for not doing more to confront Iran, not doing more to stand up to Iran. And yeah, he raises a good question. Why is Europe enabling this anti-Semitic power? Why are they not really concerned that they're trying to support this Iran deal that makes it easier for Iran to get the bomb? And they're not really concerned about the repercussions of that. Why is that? And that's a good question. Now, there's, like we said, a lot of disturbing history behind this anti-Semitism. And you can really see the world starting to repeat the history of the 1930s, the 1940s. William Manchester, in his book *The Last Lion*, one of the books that's been one of the book club books, he talks a fair bit about the growing in anti-Semitism and the way that it became more and more common throughout the 1930s. He wrote, "The martyrdom of Jews in the 1940s would strip anti-Semitism in Britain of its respectability, but in the 1930s it was quite an ordinary thing to see restaurants, hotels, clubs, beaches, and residential neighborhoods barred to people with what were delicately called dietary requirements." He writes that contempt for Jews was not considered bad form. They were widely regarded as unlovable alien, loudmouthed, flashy persons who enriched themselves at the expense of Gentiles. And there was people in government, high society, intellectuals, the media, obviously with people that weren't involved in this, but infected with anti-Semitism. Going back to William Manchester's book, he wrote, "Ladies wore bracelets with swastika charms. Young men combed their hair slant across their forehead. Even Britain's king, Edward VIII, he was king for just a pretty short time, but he was an open admirer of Hitler." And then Manchester goes into what was going on in Europe. He wrote, "Poland's national character, like Germany's, was marred by a livid streak of anti-Semitism. In Hungary, there are anti-Semitic laws." This was something rising up across the whole continent. There were, he goes more into Germany, what was going on in the 1930s with motion picture theatres, shops and restaurants were displaying prominent signs saying "Jews not welcome" or "Jews not admitted," just even into shops. He writes that at every turn they were taunted. He talks about even in America. And others have talked about that. Professor Leonard Dinnerstein, he said the worst period of American anti-Semitism was sandwiched between the ends of World War I and World War II. Mr. McDonald, Trumpet Editor-in-Chief, Trumpet.com Managing Editor Brad McDonald, he had an article on anti-Semitism, "Why You Should Be Alarmed." And he wrote, "Call this 1930s-style anti-Semitism, if you will, and history shows that unless it is checked, it leads directly to Jews being gassed and tossed like worthless fodder into ovens, or what, in hindsight, we might be called 1940s-style anti-Semitism." We've seen where this leads, and we're seeing it rise again. And we can learn a lot from that history. There's plenty of long history of anti-Semitism in the world. But the Bible also prophesies that we are heading into a new era of anti-Semitism, and you can see that building already. You know, there are several prophecies that we point to regularly that have a strong component of anti-Semitism. And one of these that we bring up quite regularly is Psalm 83. And this talks about this alliance building in the Middle East. It lists a whole bunch of different Middle Eastern countries. And it says that Asher is joined with them, referring to Assyria or modern-day Germany. And so it lists a conglomeration of Middle Eastern nations that ally together with Germany for a single cause. And in Psalm 83, in verse 4 and 5, describe why they come together. It says, "They have said, 'Come in, Come and let us cut them off from being a nation. Talking about Israel. Let's cut Israel off from being a nation, that the name of Israel may no more be in remembrance. For they have consulted together with one consent, and they are confederate against thee. They want to just wipe Israel out. That shows a pretty big level of hatred and even anti-Semitism. Trumpet managing editor Gerald Flurry, he talked about this and commented on this on a Key of David program. Here's just on Psalm 83. Here's just a quick comment from that program.
Now, Ahmadinejad of Iran, the leader there, has said, we're going to wipe Israel off the map. But here is an even more diabolical plot that they want to just absolutely obliterate the name of Israel forever in this confederation of Psalm 83. What does it all mean? Well, we need to understand.
He writes in the King of the South booklet, what you see being talked about in Psalm 83 is an even deeper hatred for Israel than you see in Iran. They want to just wipe the name, not just wipe it off the map, but take that name so that it's not even remembered. Now, this prophecy, it's talking about Israel in general. And the Jews are the descendants of one tribe of Israel, Judah. There are more tribes, and this verse is talking really about all of those tribes, it's not just referring to Judah. You can look in your Bible and look even in just about any kind of history book that the nation of Israel in ancient times, it split. You had the nations of Judah, or Judah split into one, and then you had 10 tribes of Israel that became another separate nation. And these were taken into captivity by Assyria 100 years or so before Judah went into captivity. They're often referred to as the Lost 10 Tribes. And again, you can look that up pretty easily. But the Bible prophesies that all these tribes would be major nations, not just Judah. The world doesn't know where these 10 tribes went. But you can look at Genesis chapter 49, for example, and it has very specific prophecies for every single tribe. And it says that these prophecies are for the latter days. These are for the end times. These are for times thousands of years in the future from when Genesis 49 was written. Well, these nations would have to be somewhere for these prophecies to be true. These nations have the lost 10 tribes of Israel. They need to be somewhere. Otherwise, your Bible is wrong. Otherwise, many of these passages, like Genesis 49 and so many others, have completely failed. Now, we have our free book, The United States and Britain in Prophecy, that shows you who these tribes are, that Britain and America are descended from these tribes, that they're the recipients of the very specific blessings prophesied in the book of Genesis and elsewhere. And if you haven't read that book already, please do read that. You can get that online at our website, thetrumpet.com. Just go there and click on the literature tab at the top right-hand corner, and you can go to our library. You can read online on all of our books. You can order yourself a free copy. If you have any trouble, you can shoot us an email at td@kpcg.fm. So there's a group, but there's going to be this hatred directed at all Israel, but that does include Judah. And that's building. But then you look into history and even into the Bible, and you can see there's a certain amount of hatred directed specifically against Judah. And the Bible prophesies that this will continue to rise. Jeremiah 7 talks about Jerusalem being attacked and overcome by this Psalm 83 alliance. There are many other scriptures that talk about this alliance of nations conquering Jerusalem. Zechariah 14, for example, talks about this. So just like Psalm 83, Jeremiah 7 talks about this, and then Jeremiah 8 describes what happens next. And I'll read the first couple of verses of Jeremiah 8. It says, at that time, says the Eternal, they shall bring out the bones of the kings of Judah, and the bones of his princes, and the bones of the priests, and the bones of the prophets, and the bones of the inhabitants of Jerusalem out of their graves. And they shall spread them before the sun and the moon, and all the host of heaven, whom they have loved, and whom they have served, and after whom they have walked, and whom they have sought, and whom they have worshipped. And they shall not be gathered nor buried, for they shall be for dung upon the face of the earth. This power takes these bones of these kings even, these ancient, incredibly valuable relics, bones of people talked about in the Bible, and just spreads them out like they're dung, deliberately tries to desecrate them. Now, we don't have these bones yet. They haven't been dug up. You can't go to Jerusalem and see these bones of these kings on display somewhere, but the Bible prophesies that the tombs of Israel's, of Judah's kings, will be found before Jerusalem goes into captivity. But you'd have thought, just if, say, logically, just thinking logically and rationally, that this power, this European power allied with these Arab nations that comes in and takes Jerusalem, you'd thought they would highly value these bones, you know, just for their historical value. And you don't even have to believe the Bible to believe that the bones of, say, King David or King Hezekiah would be pretty incredible to find, pretty valuable, something you'd want to put on display. But there's so much hatred there, they just want to wipe this out, to desecrate them, spread them on the face of the earth like dung, and just try and have that name of Israel obliterated. There's an irrational level of hatred there. Just like you saw in World War II, where Andrew Roberts points out in his book on the Storm of War that even from, you know, from a rational perspective, Hitler's attack on the Jews and the Holocaust didn't make any military sense, and Germany may have been, or would have been, much more effective in the war if they hadn't have done it. There's just an irrational hatred there. So why? Where does this irrational hatred come from? Well, here's what Trumpet Editor-in-Chief Gerald Flurry wrote in Chapter 8 of his book, The Key of David. He writes, "So why is there so much hatred for the Jews? Look at the Middle East today. The Jews of the tiny nation of Israel are despised by their neighbors. Many Arabs want to see the Jewish nation destroyed. In our time, the Jews have been hated in Russia. There is still anti-Semitism in the United States and other countries. And can we forget what Hitler and his Nazi scourge did to the Jews? Where is all of this hate coming from? A thinking person has to wonder. We know the Jews, like all humans, have helped to create some of their own problems, but we must see that there is something deeper behind anti-Semitism. We have to see there's something deeper behind this. Where is this coming from? Well, there's a couple of things you have to know to understand where it is coming from. First is that God has a plan. You know, he's working out a plan, and that plan involves Israel. Look in the Old Testament. So much of that, what's recorded in there, is the history of ancient Israel. And so much of that is written by the Jews. And then another important truth that you need to understand is that there is a devil. The Bible's very clear about that. Ephesians 2 and verse 2 says that, you know, he works on people's moods. He influences the world. He works on emotions. He stirs people to irrational emotions. Mr. Flurry, in that booklet, he continued, "Satan the devil understands the plan of God. He has a great hatred for God because of the plan of God. He has a great hatred for God. Because of the plan of God, the word Jew can really stir up Satan's wrath. The Jews are a type of what all men are to become spiritually. It is God's association with the Jews that has been inspired by Satan." I missed a line there. "It is God's association with the Jews that has turned Satan even more violently against them. Hatred for the Jews has been inspired by Satan. He knows that he was never offered what has been offered to mankind. He wants nothing more than to destroy the plan of God. Satan can stir up vicious hatred. He loves to use out-of-control emotion. A religion taken to the extreme, such as radical Islam, gives him a great field to work in. Nazi Germany established a fanatical hatred for the Jews. The Nazis used emotion to stir up a repugnant hatred. The coming beast power will exhibit the same hatred for the Jews as well." So this is why anti-Semitism is a great barometer of crisis. When it's rising, it shows that Satan is really directing and influencing minds, and those Satan-directed and influenced minds are really gaining power in the world. I'm rapidly running out of time, but you can read in Genesis chapter 49 and verse 10 and 11 that God has a promise there about a throne. That's the scepter shall not depart from Judah. There was a promise that this throne would remain in a descendant of Judah. You can read in Luke chapter 1 and verse 35 that Jesus Christ will rule from this same throne of David, David being a descendant of Judah. And this is why this beast power so horribly vandalizes the bones of the kings in Jeremiah 8. Mr. Frey wrote about that scripture in Jeremiah 8, that Satan hates David's throne more than any throne on earth because it is about to replace his throne forever. In the Key of David, he writes that Satan has also stirred up much trouble for the nation of Israel. Just look at the British royal family. It has the royal Jewish heritage of King David himself. But today the monarchy has been so battered and bruised and beaten it will never recover the dignity it once had. It says, who is the driving force behind the deformation of that royal family? Satan the devil. He desires to bring as much indignity to that throne as possible. And hatred to this throne, it even goes all the way back to that Israel split from Judah, goes back to hatred for that throne. You can also read in the Key of David booklet in that chapter that the Jews played a major role in preserving God's law and God's truth. And so there's an evil spirit behind this hatred that's rising, and that's behind a lot of this animosity. Now, as sobering as this truth is, there is an inspiring part of this. God has a plan. He has a throne that will soon rule over the earth and bring peace to the earth that's connected with physical men. And just like this is a throne of a man, a Jew, David, this is a throne that Jesus Christ will share. Men will have the opportunity to be born into God's family and share that throne. Satan attacks Jews or hates Jews. He inspires attacks against them. Those attacks are rising. The Bible makes clear they'll get worse. But at the end of this day, this is about Satan violently and viciously, but ultimately vainly raging against God's plan. God has a plan for everyone who's ever lived, even those destroyed by anti-Semitism. Satan is raging against this because he knows he has but a short time. He is about to be locked away forever, and anti-Semitism is about to be destroyed forever as we see this wonderful plan that God has progressing and moving forward. You can read more about that plan in chapter 8 of the Key of David booklet. Thanks for listening. That's about all I have got time for. And please be sure to tune in for tomorrow for Mr. McDonald here at kpcg.fm.